morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring, goes the bell.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lainey Hampson. Welcome to our show, Talk Out of School, on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM, where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, the state level, and nationally. Our show is also available for download or as a podcast. With the protests of recent weeks against police violence, the debate over police in the schools has become even more intense. After he was elected mayor, Rudy Giuliani insisted that he wanted to transfer school safety agents to be hired, trained, and supervised by the police rather than by anyone at the Board of Education, and he got the agreement of the Board of Ed in 1998. Our first two guests, one a former principal and superintendent Matt Brom, another a former student at New York City schools, Kat Otang, will talk about some of their experiences with school safety agents. Then we will talk to Alex Rodriguez, a high school senior about to graduate and a leader of Teens Take Charge, who will talk about their campaign to save the Summer Youth Employment Program and to end discriminatory admission screens in schools. So, first of all, Matt, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Thank you so much for joining the show. Can you first tell us a little bit about your background as a principal and a superintendent?
Yes, I was a principal at PS 88 in District 24 for approximately 5 years. Then I became a middle school principal in District 27 for about the same amount of time before I became superintendent of Community School District 27. Which encompasses from the Rockaways to Woodhaven, Queens, about 90 square miles. And I had 40 schools at that time under my supervision.
And so you were a principal when Rudy Giuliani first proposed transferring the school safety agents to the police department. Is that right?
Yes.
And what was your reaction at that time to that idea?
I, at that point in time, I was a district rep for the Council of Supervisors and Principals and Administrators of New York City, and I opposed it very strongly. And I went to a meeting where Deputy Chancellor Harry Spence was putting out the groundwork. And the question became, who makes the final decision if a child is either in need of clinical services or is acting out, but not acting out enough to be arrested? And his response was that the school safety agent would now make that decision.
And not the principal.
Not the principal. And I opposed that very strongly. Still do.
And what happened when you brought that up with the Board of Ed people? I mean, what was the reaction in general among the other people in that meeting?
To the most part, I think the principals were very supportive, but we realized we were powerless. This was a deal that was cut with the Chancellor's Office and the Central Board. It was a political decision. It was something that the mayor wanted very strongly. And basically, our sentiments were not respected.
Mm-hmm. So after this actually did go through and the school safety agents became trained, supervised, and hired by the police, What happened at your school?
Well, the first thing is when school safety agents were under the Board of Education, which is now Department of Education, they reported to the principal. We would meet. We would talk about schedules. We would talk about assignments. At dismissal time and arrival time, I could post them where I wanted to post them. If there was an altercation across the street, I crossed the street, they crossed with me. It was a flexible situation. And this is not a political issue to me. This is a school leadership issue to me. So once they changed, they were now reporting to either a lieutenant or a sergeant at the local precinct. And once that happened, they were assigned posts that they could not move from. So therefore, if there was an altercation across the street, if I needed them to move somewhere for dismissal, they would not follow that rule because I wasn't their boss anymore. And that created its situations. Also, we did have a situation where a child was suicidal and was trying to jump out the window, and we got there in time, thank God, and prevented it. But in so doing, he swung wildly and hit an agent. And the agent wanted him arrested, and I wanted him taken to the hospital. And I had to get his supervisor in my building to overrule him.
And so you actually won that argument, but it was an argument and a struggle to get that student with the proper services and not being arrested.
Absolutely.
And were there other instances in which you saw students treated roughly or arrested unnecessarily?
Yeah, I was fortunate. To the most part, my school safety agents worked with me. But I know of instances in schools where, unfortunately, there's been an overreaction to a situation that could have been handled differently. The guidance staff, the clinical staff, you know, has to be involved in these situations. And sometimes these school safety agents will operate as independent people, and you wind up with a crisis that the principal has no idea is going on. And then he has to face the parents, and he has to face the community and explain to them what happened, even though he is powerless to prevent it.
Right. And there was a story recent years of a principal coming to the defense of one of their students from a school safety agent and ending up being arrested himself.
Yes.
Which is really totally egregious. You wrote about this on our blog recently, the New York City Public School Parents blog, and you also talked about another story in which there was a fight of students right across the street from your school. Could you talk about that story?
Right. I had a junior high school of approximately 3,000 students, and unfortunately, sometimes there would be an altercation. The idea of an altercation is you go, you break it up before someone gets hurt, and you bring them back in the building, and you have a conversation as to what occurred. And depending on how serious it was, then you take appropriate disciplinary action. Once these SSAs did that across the street, it put my staff and me in the situation of having to pull the kids apart, which means we're touching them physically, which we don't want to do. And now we have to bring them back in the building. And only when we got them back in the building did the SSAs now take action. But, you know, kids sometimes do foolish things, especially in the middle school. You know, you have a basketball game going on, and two kids elbow each other, and they start to have a fight. That's a guidance issue. You bring them in, you do mediation. I had teachers trained in mediation, and you call the parents, and you resolve it that way. Sometimes the school safety agents will say, well, that's an assault, and we should be taking him to the precinct. And I think that creates future conflict. And that's what I was trying to avoid. I was a strong disciplinarian. I believe the principal's role is to maintain school safety, number one, for all members of that community. But at the same time, I don't think every incident needs to be addressed by school safety agents. And I think if they were under the leadership of the principal, then the principal could train them and assign them and give them help in terms of de-escalating situations, giving them help in terms of being part of a guidance program, having them speak to the classroom. You could do so many more things if the school leaders were given the freedom to do it.
Right. Well, another point that has been made by many is that we have more than 5,000 school safety agents in our schools, which is more than the number of guidance counselors, psychologists, and social workers put together, and that lots of schools don't have any counselors at all, and that's one thing that we need to deal with, to improve. And there was also, I don't know whether you saw, I just saw it this morning, a letter sent by hundreds of school leaders to the mayor urging him to place school safety officers under the training and supervision of the DOE and retraining them as school peace officers with a focus on de-escalation, mediation, and restorative practices. So I assume that you agree with that.
Absolutely. We want them, school safety agents, sometimes they don't like it, but sometimes they're called security guards. It has a different meaning than a peace officer. Mm-hmm. So I agree 100% with that. And also, it is terrible, the lack of guidance services, social workers, and school psychologists in the system.
Yeah.
Some schools have a guidance counselor 2 days a week. I mean, the other school has it 3 days a week. Well, what do you do on those 3 days when you don't have a guidance counselor and you have a child in crisis?
Right. And next year, given everything that the students have had to deal with, they're going to need that support even more than ever before. So thank you so much for joining us, Matt. I really appreciate you being here. Your knowledge and experience is so important right now. So thanks so much, and be well.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And you be well, and everybody be safe. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So my next guest is Kat Oteng. Kat graduated from New York City High Schools in 2016. She's now a college student and a member of the YaYa Network, which is one of several youth and advocacy groups that have focused on stopping the school-to-prison pipeline and have been campaigning for many years for school safety agents to be removed from schools and replaced with more counselors, social workers, and psychologists. And recently, both the Minneapolis and Portland, Oregon school districts have voted to do just that. Kat, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. How are you?
Hi, good. Kat, so much. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for your work. Thank you.
Yeah, recently you were part of a press conference to press for big cuts to the police budget and the elimination of the school safety agents. The press conference included an ingenious play in which the students took the roles of mayor and several council members with words taken from their own comments at hearings into the press, and some of the participants described their experiences at schools with school safety agents. Kat, can you read from your very powerful statement about what your experiences were like with school safety agents at your school?
Okay, sure. Okay, so growing up, going to high school with heavy school security, I didn't think twice about having to take my shoes off to get through metal detectors or having to throw out my snapples because glass drinks weren't allowed inside. I didn't think twice when I would constantly be harassed by school safety officers in the hallways to go to class. They were more of a constant presence to me than any guidance counselor or therapist, who were limited in their time because there were so little of them than there were students. I hadn't thought about it until I met students going to schools in other districts and found out they didn't have to go through that same nuisance. The students who didn't go through these things went to schools with the majority white population. Being that my entire primary and secondary education was based where I live, I hadn't been in a class with a white student until I entered college. New York City schools are still segregated, and this was visible with the disproportionate influence of school safety and the NYPD in schools. I was surrounded by law enforcement so much in my childhood, I thought that it had been normal. I never struck up conversations with them as they never did with me. There were never any healthy bonds or relationships I saw built between school safety officers and the students. They were just there as a source of coldness, eyes watching but never trying to understand. They felt no different than the type of gaze I'd receive when I would walk into stores and be followed around for none other than the fact that my skin was black, always suspected without ever having done anything. While my white counterparts are able to freely go to school and walk through stores without being seen as criminals. This is also apparent in the numbers. Quote, 25% of the youth in New York City is black, yet 65% of the youth detained in juvenile detention facilities are black. 26% of New York City youth are white, but only 3% of the youth detained in juvenile detention centers are white. And this is from the Alliance of Quality Education and Public Policy and Education for New York, the report that was on systematic racism released in June 2019. Black children don't even make up the majority of youth in New York City, but we are the majority in juvenile cells, and that is extremely disheartening. Students go to school to ensure a future for themselves, and at the same time, they could potentially be ensuring a spot in a cell. not only do Black students have limited opportunities, but we have to put up with the obstacles that come with wanting better for ourselves. Schools endorse segregation and mass incarceration through the school-to-prison pipeline, leaving disciplinary measures at the hands of the NYPD, especially with the racial tensions present with them and the police brutality today, is lazy and cowardice. The New York Department of Education needs to hold accountability for the trauma they've put Black and Latinx students through in schools. It's time for the removal of metal detectors, reduction of school safety officers, and an influx of school psychologists. Let's start to foster a learning environment with restorative school safety measures that our Black and Latinx students deserve.
Thank you. That was so good. So the mayor has proposed a hiring freeze on all new teachers, social workers, and counselors next year, and a 3% cut to the Department of Education's budget, despite the fact that we'll need more teachers and counselors than ever before. But there will be no freeze, he proposes, on the more than 5,000 school safety agents, which will have their budget actually increased by nearly $20 million to $427 million. Kat, assuming that school safety agents are cut or eliminated, what would better ensure the safety of students and staff at schools instead?
Where the money could be better put to building a true community and a stronger support system for the students, there are tons of organizations out there that are already working very hard for students, such as the YaYa Network, and are devoted to making sure that the futures of these children's lives are secured. I relied on the College Access Center through my high school experience, and because of that center, I was able to go to college and was able to receive that support. So if our money was being put more towards a system such as those, then we would be ensuring that our youth have a better future for themselves. And also having the money, like reinstating the Summer Youth Employment Program, which a lot of youth depend on it. Also, programs such as Aspira NYC, Integrate New York City, Youth United, Youth Over Guns. Basically, defunding the police is the bare minimum that we can do for our students. The funds should be going into housing, the community, community businesses that actually make sure that there is a genuine relationship between each and every single member of that community. We need to give our students options by investing in mental health care facilities and hiring more teachers and school psychologists, and making sure that we are there at this trying period of their lives, because being young is not easy. There's a ton of things that you can go through along with growing up, and then having to deal with things, having to worry about where you have to put your head at night should not be a problem for a child. It should not. They should not have to worry about what they have to eat. But instead, the money is going to the police when it should be going to housing. It should be going to food security. It should be going to communities that have food deserts. So basically instilling community care providers who know who they're working for. There's a city in New Jersey called Camden who actually disbanded their entire force, only rehiring 100 officers, and over 7 years, their crime levels went down significantly, and they also enforced a relationship and a bond between the officers and the community by having these community engagement programs. So, like, they knew who they were protecting, and that's what makes all the difference, is to build that community.
So, go ahead.
Another point that I wanted to make was that being that policing has a historical context that policing does have, it has roots in slavery. It doesn't necessarily, is not conducive to a culturally competent learning environment for Black and brown students. And it only adds to the nearly inescapable lingering presence of a system that was meant to keep Black people in bondage. So that's the message that officers send when they're in the school. That's the message that I felt. We also see this as, like, for the past 5 years, under the School Safety Act, the police are required to let us know what exactly is coming through metal detectors. what they find, how many of them are there, what is getting removed, all of these things. But since 2016, they've been ignoring this law and they've got away with it. And it's much like how qualified immunity protects police officers. I also want to bring the point, I'm sorry, I'm kind of like jumping all over the place, but I also want to bring the point that the safety had not been introduced until 1998, which means before I was born, there were no such thing as safety officers, and they were not such a significant presence. So we can go back to that, and we can build something even stronger.
Right. Well, they were under the supervision of principals, which is what our previous guest talked about, and therefore I think we're really more integral to the school community. What should people do if they want to help your campaign to eliminate or cut the number of school safety agents in the schools?
I would say donate, like open up your purse and basically get involved. Reach out to different organizations and see how exactly like they need you. A lot of the support that has been going on like throughout the Black Lives Movement currently has been through petitions and donating to different orgs, showing up to protests, but not only showing up to protests, showing up to press conferences, keeping up with what is going on and what is happening, speaking to city council members. That is basically the majority of the work that we do. So I would say that is what the type of support that people can give us.
Okay. Well, we will have the link to the Yaya Network and the Dignity in Schools campaign on our blog and on the link to the podcast so that people can find out more about the campaign and hopefully support it with advocacy. Thank you so much for being here, Kat, and sharing your experiences and thoughts with us. And good luck with this
Thank
campaign.
You.
Thank you. Thank you for so much. This is Leonie Hameson with Talk Out of School, WBAI FM 99.5 on your dial or online at WBAI.org. Our show is also available for download as a podcast. Please consider donating to WBAI to keep us on the air. And if you want to support this show, you can become a WBAI buddy to Talk Out of School by logging into givetowbai.org or calling 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. Before I bring in our next guest, I just wanted to let people know that Class Size Matters and New York City Kids PAC are holding a special conference online on June 20th from 11 to 1 p.m. on school reopening to bring together parents, students, educators, and others to figure out how schools should be reopened to ensure health and safety and maximum academic and social emotional support. To prepare for this conference, we've posted a survey for New Yorkers to fill out at tinyurl.com/survey-reopen-schools. That's tinyurl.com/survey-reopen-schools. The link will also be at the podcast and at the WBAI site. I want to encourage listeners to fill it out to share your ideas and concerns. Our next guest will be Alex Rodriguez, a high school senior at Urban Assembly School for Law and Justice, about to graduate, and a member of Teens Take Charge, to talk about the focus of their campaigns to save the Summer Youth Employment Program and also to end admission screens at New York City middle schools and high schools. Alex, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Leonie.
Good morning, Alex. Thank you for coming. Can
of
you
course.
Explain what the Summer Youth Employment Program is and why Teens Take Charge is fighting to keep it going?
Yeah. So the Summer Youth Employment, or also known as SYEP, provides thousands of jobs to youth over the summer to gain professional experience in all types of fields. And so last year, about 75,000 jobs were given to young people to gain such experience in all types, from like summer camps, working in hospitals, nonprofit work.
And so what did the mayor propose, and why are you opposing that?
Yeah, so it was kind of a shock to us to hear that the mayor was considering to completely cutting the program during a time of obvious great economic hardship and challenges. And so to think that the mayor was going to cut an opportunity for youth to gain money and earn money in a time that, quite frankly, a lot of disparaged families need was just ridiculous. And so over the course of quarantine, we were able to, you know, rally the troops kind of and really advocate for the saving of this program because youth, specifically youth of color, depend on it.
It was one of the most effective campaigns I've ever seen from any advocacy group. You had an action of the day, and you specifically targeted specific city council members to sign on to the restoration of the funds. And then just a few days ago, the mayor announced that he would restore these funds, or at least much of these funds, though I don't think he's specifically saying the entire program. But it was really a terrific campaign. Now, do you have, I've also seen on your website for Teens Take Charge, you have some great proposals of the work that youth could be done in the midst of this pandemic, either remotely or in person. Could you talk about those proposals a little?
Yeah, so in regards to SYEP or other campaigns?
SYEP specifically, the kinds of jobs that could be assigned to youth in this time of need.
Yeah, so, I mean, though the budget remains unclear, we do know that there will be, like, funding reserved for SYEP, and a lot of the orgs and public partnerships have kind of elements of the programming set. So I think we really just need to see how much exactly of the slots will be saved. And, like, a lot of things will vary really depending on, like, how opened up the state will be and the city will be, obviously, because we are living in unprecedented times. But there will be some type of virtual component. I mean, obviously, if, like, summer camps are allowed, which we did hear, things of summer camps kind of opening up, it is something that we kind of support. And a lot of the career components will be saved, and it will most likely be stipended and not, like, a minimum wage situation.
Some of the other possibilities and options that were mentioned on your website, which I thought were really, really interesting, was helping with relief activities to bring food and supplies to people who are quarantined, and also the possibility of tutoring and mentoring younger students who are struggling, some of them as never before, with the shutdown of schools, and that could be done either remotely or in person if you maintain social distancing. And I just thought that was a really, really, really good idea. Have you, since the mayor has announced the restoration of at least some of these funds, have you guys been in discussion with the mayor's office or the Department of Youth and Community Development, which basically runs these youth jobs, summer youth jobs employment program, as to how they might be structured? Have they entered into any dialogue with you?
Well, like the DYCD obviously wants to do it and is in support of keeping the program. I think it really is just, we're just waiting out to hear, like, how much of the funding is going to be given to this program. Like I said, a lot of the program elements are worked out. It really just depends on what the mayor has to say.
But so you've been in no specific discussions with the mayor's office or DYCD about how much would be allotted to the program and how it might be structured?
No, a lot of the kind of numbers in that kind of situation is still in this kind of questioning phase. So we strongly want the full program to be saved.
And so the other major campaign that Teens Take Charge has been involved in advocating for a number of years now is ending admission screens in New York City public schools. Can you explain what admission screens means and why you oppose them?
Yeah, so admission screens are essentially kind of filters, and schools choose to opt into these filters that limit or obviously not allow certain types of students from getting into them, schools like Beacon, schools like Elro, schools like the specialized schools. They have tons of different types of screens that obviously the school kind of opts into them in order to kind of prevent students in which they deem like not well performing from getting into the school. And so we have long advocated, I want to say since the founding of Teens Take Charge, we have long advocated for the elimination of discriminatory screens, which quite frankly means all of them. And we want to move to a universal kind of adopt, ask model so that schools can be representative of the city's student performance as a whole. So no one school would have like crazy numbers, like 99% of students like above grade level, but rather everything being representative of the city.
So just a little bit of history for our listeners. I think it was under Chancellor Rudy Crewe that he developed a system of educational option schools in which the schools would balance their admissions to have relatively equal numbers of kids above grade level, at grade level, and below grade level to ensure consistency and equity among different high schools. But then when Mayor Bloomberg came in, Chancellor Klein, they created more and more selective programs and selective high schools, and there were fewer and fewer educational option schools. Is that correct?
Yes.
And part of the reason, you know, many people believe that the system of having more balanced admissions at these schools died is because of the increased pressure put on high schools to get good grades and to have high graduation rates and also very high test score rates. And as schools were pushed harder and harder on those accountability measures and risked being closed if they didn't, more and more schools adopted these sorts of admission screens, which led to more and more disparities among schools, not just in terms of admissions achievement, but also in terms of the racial breakdown of the students at the schools. Is that right?
Yeah, and like I do want to say one thing, though. It's like our school system, New York City, should not be having, New York City students should not have to talk about education as though under a mindset of scarcity. We all deserve an education that is well-funded and well-protected, and especially for youth of color. And what we're opting for is that, like, we can move on to a system in which your grades will not be put against you, where you can still gain an education that is well-dignified and respected by the state.
So, I want to play devil's advocate now, and I want to bring up the arguments that some parents make who oppose the ending of admission screens in schools. And what they say is the following. We have put a lot of time and effort into making sure that our children work hard and succeed and get high grades and high test scores. Our children have also worked very hard to attain these measures, and they deserve to get into the more selective schools. They deserve to get into the schools with other students just like them so that they continue to succeed in life. What is your response to that argument?
Well, I'd first like to say that these parents, a lot of these parents have a name, and they're coming from an organization called Place NYC. And as an individual, I just like to say that it's disgusting that parents who quite frankly know nothing about what it's being like inside the New York City school system are kind of using their privilege to just commercialize the social and emotional disparities that many youth, specifically black and brown youth in the city, face. I'd also just like to say the fact that they're kind of marketing themselves as real parents who worked hard for their children to get into these competitive schools, which honestly are just a handful of the same predominantly white institutions such as Beacon, the specialized schools, Eleanor Roosevelt. I think it's kind of really almost quite appalling to think that these parents are calling themselves real parents because they were able to put superficial resources like money into prep programs to make sure that their kids get in these educations, because my personal mother hasn't had the opportunity to gain so much wealth and put me in all these types of prep programs. But I'd be damned to say if she did not work hard to get me where I was today. And I think that those arguments are rooted in euphemisms that are tied to slurs and just a lot of racist constructed minds. And I think that they seriously need to reconsider what they're fighting for, because they're not fighting for their children. It honestly just seems like a personal vendetta against Black and brown youth in the city.
So one of the issues that has brought this issue even more to the fore this year is the fact that with this shutdown of schools and the introduction of remote learning, many parents and students have not had the same access to the internet, have not had the same access to their teachers, are dealing with all sorts of struggles at home, including loss of jobs and possible ill health, and even the death of their parents, given the pandemic. And so the disparities that already existed among schools and the background of students are magnified during this crisis. And so the DOE has determined that I think that there will be no grades at the end of this year. There'll be a system either pass-fail and or pass-fail and incomplete. And the state was unable to give the state tests as well because of the pandemic. And usually in most schools that are selective, the admissions are based upon fourth grade tests and grades for middle school and seventh grade grades and test scores for high school. And next year, those will not exist for those grade levels. So the DOE is going around and holding sessions with many different parent groups to talk about what the admissions should be like the following year for middle schools, for selective middle schools and high schools. Has the DOE reached out to your group, Teens Take Charge, to discuss with you your ideas?
Yes, they have. They actually reached out to us pretty early in quarantine, asking us what we think about remote learning, what are things that they can implement when it comes to technology access, programs that they can offer, or support services for students. And we've been pretty vocal on that. It's nothing new that we have been fighting for, the transition of a universal system. They know it. We've talked to them about it during this time. They've reached out to us asking about our opinions plenty of times, specifically the Office of Enrollment. And so we've kind of really purported for the ideas of grades not coming to harm when it comes to students' schools, and kind of moving on to this, like, screenless school system.
Well, you told me when we spoke before the show that, Deputy Chancellor Josh Wallach is the one that's doing a lot of these remote meetings with parents, and you actually had to crash one of these meetings to get an introduction to him to have a discussion specifically about what admissions are going to be used next year. Is that true? Could you talk a little bit about that?
So there was a meeting with the organization Place that I mentioned earlier, and it was pretty difficult to get on board. And so they've kind of were talking about, obviously, like, keeping a discriminatory screens, and they were kind of saying a lot of things that you mentioned earlier. A lot of our team kind of had difficulty finding this link because it was a little bit crazy to, get access to this call. But we ended up having it, and Josh Wallach also reached out to us saying that he wants to speak to us again after knowing that we were in that call.
But has that that meeting or discussion been scheduled yet?
We're still planning for that.
And so your position, I suppose, is that you know, that the admission screens need to be eliminated completely as soon as possible, and that next year would be a good year to start given the unreliability of grades and the non-existence of test scores at this time. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that if this time has proven anything, it's that, like, we as a people really cannot wait to allow oppressive systems that, quite frankly, is the New York City education system to continue to perpetuate cycles of poverty and discrimination. So we need to transition to this system as soon as possible.
And as you continue to advocate for this, I know that you were going to have a school boycott that was scheduled for May, but because of the pandemic, that was called off. What sorts of actions do you have planned for the future in terms of advocacy?
Liana, you're going to get me in trouble here. so we're still, obviously, like, with our two campaigns, we're very busy. There's a lot of conversation amongst us, youth, planning about what potential things we can do, but we're still trying to find other ways that we can continue this work, obviously while keeping in mind, like, the public health of the city and things like that. Though we were unable to have our boycott, the work still has to continue, and so we're currently strategizing on ways on what are things that we can also do.
And so you're graduating today, is that correct?
I'm not graduating today now.
You're graduating in the next few days or something like
yes.
that, right?
Yes, yeah.
And you're going on to college, and a lot of the youth leaders of Teen Take Charge are going on to college. Do you have a next generation of leadership taking over?
Yes, yeah. So we've actually been working very hard to kind of pass the baton, so to speak, to a lot of our other family in the Teen Take Charge group. And so, I mean, really, like, just, it's phenomenal to think that, like, it's time to kind of move on in, like, this really, like, sad but also, like, really hopeful kind of way. But, yeah, we're fully equipped to kind of, you know, pass the baton and start to mentor the future leaders of this movement.
And will you continue to be engaged in this issue even after you've gone to college?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate that, you know, all the work that you've done. I think it's going to be a hard battle, but it's an important battle, especially because so many schools have been selective. There's a real cost, I think, on students themselves who feel tremendous pressure starting sometimes as early as, you know, second and third grade to get good test scores, to get good grades. And then there's an atmosphere of tremendous competition and stress that are put on kids when they're very young that is not a healthy environment for learning. Do you feel similarly?
In regards to, like, testing, yeah, I think testing is so rooted in honestly just kind of racism and the crazy systems that we have to live into, as just, especially as a youth of color. I 100% feel similarly, and I think especially being a first-generation student, I've had lots of challenges in my life when it comes to a lot of, like, even just my own kind of ideas of what it means to be worth something is, unfortunately, has been tied to what I get on a test grade. And so that has motivated me to really work hard and do my very best. I can't say that, like, it hasn't, like, been detrimental in whatever way that it has.
I think that most people, or a lot of people who live in New York City and send their kids to public school in New York City, are not aware that in most of the country there are no such things as selective middle schools and high schools, or very few of
yeah.
them. There may be advanced placement courses, there may be gifted programs, but in general, middle schools and high schools enroll everybody who lives in the community.
Yeah.
And there's and, a... go on.
No, I was just going to say, it's crazy to think that, like, the specialized high school system is the only high school system in the entire country that uses one sole factor for entry, which is the specialized high school test. And we all are very familiar with why that is, with the Hatch-Calandra law. And it also kind of goes hand in hand with the report that came out, I want to say 5 or so years ago, by UCLA, written by Gary Orfield, that said that New York City has the most racially segregated school system in the entire country as well.
Yeah. So the issue that Alex is talking about is there is a state law which people have pressed to get eliminated but have not gotten eliminated, that required 3 specific high schools in New York City to base admissions on a sole high-stakes test. That's Stuyvesant High School, Bronx Science, and Brooklyn Tech. But actually, under Mayor Bloomberg, they added 5 more selective high schools based admissions upon that single test. And in fact, the mayor and the chancellor could take those 5 schools out at any time. But they have not done so for reasons that we don't understand. And it is true that New York City is the only district in the entire country that bases any admissions solely on 1 high-stakes test. And we have 8 of those schools here in New York City. And there has been a push to get the state law changed that has so far stalled in the legislature. But I think it's a debate that's going to be renewed next year and on into the future, because a vanishingly small number of kids of color are admitted to these schools, and it seems to be fewer and fewer over time. And that's go on.
Oh, I just wanted to say that we have come for the New York City Council. We have come for the mayor, the chancellor of education, and we're also I didn't mention this to you yesterday, but we're also going to be actually working to strategize to repeal the Hatch-Calandra law as well. So putting state legislator on notice when it comes to that. And I'm really confident in how this is going to look out, but we are thinking about what we can do to repeal this law as soon as possible. And I just want to let you all know that, like, for every 1 in 14 Stuyvesant high school students, only 1 is black.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a quite extraordinary situation. So thank you so much, Alex. I really appreciate you being here. Good luck next year. I'm sure you'll do wonderfully in college. I hope you stay in touch. And as I emailed you yesterday, you are invited to our conference on June 20th. We want students there as well to help strategize about how schools could be reopened next year to maximize health and safety and academic and emotional support. And I think it's really important that parents have input into these decisions, as well as students and teachers. And so far, there has been very little outreach by the Department of Education on that critical issue. So I hope you and other students will join us at that event.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for the opportunity.
And again, thank you for being here. You're really a tremendous guest. This is Leini Hameson, host of Talk Out of School on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio. For more information, you can link to the websites of the YaYa Network and Teens Take Charge. We will link to them at the podcast link and also on the WBAI link. Our show is available as a podcast if you missed the live version. But in any case, please consider becoming a WBAI buddy to Talk Out of School by logging into givetowbai.org or by calling 516-620-3602. Again, to prepare for the conference we're having June 20th, we've posted a survey for New Yorkers to fill out at tinyurl.com/survey-reopen-schools. I want to encourage all our listeners who live in New York City or who work in New York City to fill it out, to share your ideas and concerns about how this could happen safely. Please join us next week for another episode of Talk Out of School. Until then, be careful and be safe. Thanks so much for listening.
The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. Your fingers right down to the bone, and the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring,
in the lunchroom ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Keep it, the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke joint you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance.